of overwhelming demands placed upon it. If we agree that we are basically no different creatures than the warriors of World War I, World War II, and Korea, then we must admit that the same thing could happen to us. The goal of this audiobook and the new body of warrior science research that it is based upon is to be better trained and prepared in order to prevent that from happening to us. Chapter 3. Sympathetic and Parasympathetic Nervous Systems, the Body's Combat and Maintenance Troops. The study of war should concentrate almost entirely on the actualities of war, the effects of tiredness, hunger, fear, lack of sleep, weather, the principles of strategy and tactics, and the logistics of war are really absurdly simple. It is the actualities that make war so complicated and so difficult. Field Marshal Lord Wavell, in a letter to B.H. Littleheart. Sympathetic Nervous System, Mobilizing the Body for Survival. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood. Shakespeare, King Henry V. Your autonomic nervous system consists of the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Most of your organs receive impulses from both the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, though they generally work opposite each other. For example, the sympathetic nervous system increases your heart rate, and the parasympathetic nervous system decreases it. The sympathetic nervous system is also associated with stress response, the fight-or-flight response, as it prepares your body and mind for perceived danger. The sympathetic nervous system is generally concerned with the expenditure of energy from reserves that are stored in your body, inhibiting digestion, increasing secretion of epinephrine and norepinephrine, dilating the bronchial tubes in the lungs, dilating heart vessels and tensing muscles. The sympathetic nervous system mobilizes and directs the body's energy resources for action. Think of it as the physiological equivalent of the body's frontline soldiers, the ones who do the fighting in a military unit. The parasympathetic nervous system is associated with relaxation and is often concerned with activities that increase your body's supply of stored energy, such as salivation and digestion. It is the physiological equivalent of the body's cooks, mechanics, and clerks who sustain a military unit over an extended period of time. When you are asleep at night, the parasympathetic nervous system processes are totally ascended. You do not even have a guard at the front gate. Your military unit is on stand down. Your ship is in port, and you are completely helpless. Then you wake up in the morning, get a cup of coffee, take a shower, and you hit what is called homeostasis, a balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic processes. You have some troops in the front lines and some troops doing maintenance, which allows you to conduct sustained operations. But all units must stand down sooner or later, so that night you go to sleep, and once again your parasympathetic nervous system processes take over. This is a normal, routine maintenance cycle. Tomorrow, however, there is a surprise waiting. You get up and begin your routine. Homeostasis is established, and then suddenly, someone tries to kill you. Your body's response is total sympathetic nervous system arousal. Parasympathetic nervous system processes like digestion shut down. We don't need no stinking digestion. You guys blow the ballast and get down to the legs where we need you. The cooks, mechanics, and clerks drop what they are doing, grab a rifle, and rush to the front lines. Meanwhile, salivation may shut down, resulting in what is known as dry mouth or cotton mouth. If we can believe the data at face value, 75% of combat veterans did not lose control of bowel and bladder, but almost everyone gets what is called stress diarrhea. The Greeks say your bowels turn to water. The medical term for it is spastic colon, which is rather evocative. One of the last things many police SWAT teams do before they make a high-risk entry is to take what they call a battle crap. The body blows the ballast so that no resources are wasted on unnecessary functions. There is a total mobilization of all assets towards one thing, and one thing only, survival. As soon as the danger is over, there is a crash, a parasympathetic backlash of enormous magnitude. Parasympathetic backlash. The body shuts down for maintenance. Taken from a correspondence to Colonel Grossman. I was part of an arrest team of 7 veteran drug agents. We were doing hotel by bus, where our informant inside a hotel room would order up several pounds of drugs, and when the bad guy showed up, we would watch the deal go down via video camera from an adjoining room. To watch the actions go down in front of you, and just watching and waiting for the bus signals, all the time looking and listening to your target, raised our stress to the point of almost being able to touch it. After the first deal was made and the arrest signal was given, we made entry from the adjacent room and arrested 4 suspects and seized 2 pounds of methamphetamine. As we were taking the suspects out into the parking lot, a car pulled up, driven by an associate of our bad guys. When he backed up and headed for the exit, some of the officers ran after him, and I ran to cut him off. The car changed paths and headed straight at me. I noticed the backdrop for my shot, thinking I was going to have to kill the driver. But my teammates were in the line of fire. I jumped out of the way, and the car passed right where I had been standing. I jumped into a car, and we began a chase, eventually finding the car in a church lot. As I drove to it, I began to get the shakes. No problem, as I knew that would happen. By the time we searched the church, I figure I had experienced 3 or 4 adrenaline rushes. On the way back to the hotel, I felt very carsick, dizzy, and I had a terrible headache. I knew it was a backlash from the activities, so I began tactical breathing. That helped for a while with the headache and dizziness, but I was still very tired and had a hard time staying awake. What bothered me the most was I knew what was going on and why, but I couldn't stop it. During the Korean War, a team of psychiatrists accompanied a unit of veteran soldiers into battle. The unit got a night of good sleep and then launched an attack at dawn. By noon, they had secured an enemy hilltop position, and the immediate danger was over. While they waited for the inevitable counterattack, the psychiatrists were astounded to see that the officers and NCOs had to go from position to position, waking up the soldiers. The parasympathetic backlash after the battle had been so powerful that the men had fallen into an exhausted sleep, even though they knew they would soon be attacked. Napoleon said, "The moment of greatest vulnerability is the instant immediately after victory." As soon as the troops relaxed, there was a parasympathetic backlash of enormous magnitude. It is more than just letting down your guard. It is a powerful physiological collapse. This process is not unlike sex in the male body. You are up, you are rocking, you are down, and you're not getting back up again. There has been a physical hormonal discharge, and your body needs time to recharge itself. This is why the military always holds back a reserve. When the troops are suffering from the burden of exhaustion and a fresh enemy unit attacks, the exhausted troops collapse like a house of cards. Burning off the adrenaline dump. I had been in Vietnam as a military policeman for only a couple of weeks when I was assigned to go on a raid of several Vietnamese shops for stolen American merchandise. The owners of the first 2 shops resisted and we had to wrestle them to the floor so other MPs could recover the goods. At the third shop, things got ugly fast, when South Vietnamese soldiers armed with M16s came to the merchant's aid. Before it was over, we had about 25 MPs there, and 30 or 40 enraged Vietnamese. Shots were fired in the air. Everyone was screaming racial epithets, and several fistfights broke out. We were just a hair breadth away from shooting a couple of Vietnamese before we got order. 2 hours later, I was in the mess hall, still so wired that I had trouble picking up food with my fork. When I did spear something, my hand shook so hard, the food would slip off. I finally gave up and ate with my hands like an animal. There were other times like this, some worse, but this was the first. A Vietnam veteran. It can be a different story for police officers and other warriors who are not in sustained combat. When the average law enforcement officer gets into a gunfight, he often has trouble sleeping that night. Why did those infantry soldiers in Korea have trouble staying awake at noon? But the average law enforcement officer after a gunfight cannot get to sleep. The difference is what has happened to the adrenaline dump in the combatants' bodies. The soldiers went through 6 hours of grueling combat where they burned up every drop of adrenaline in their bodies. The police officer had the same adrenaline dump flooding through his body, but his combat event took only a few trigger pulls to resolve, leaving him with adrenaline still surging through his body. For the officer to sleep, he must first come down from his adrenaline rush. Have you ever sat on the edge of your bed at night with your mind spinning, your heart pounding, and your body raring to go? That is what residual adrenaline does to you. To burn it off, you need to conduct calisthenics, go for a long run, or lift weights. Afterward, take a shower and go back to bed. Often this is all you need to fall fast asleep. My co-author, Lauren Christensen, said that his partners often drank several beers after a high-risk situation, but he preferred to punch and kick a heavy bag until he had burned every last drop of remaining adrenaline. When he hit the pillow, he fell asleep quickly and awoke the next morning feeling good from the exercise, while his partner slept poorly and awoke with hangovers. Pacing yourself for a four-quarter game. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11. Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, a retired police supervisor and a psychologist, trains police officers on what he calls emotional survival. He talks about how the parasympathetic backlash can impact warriors every day. While they are at work, their sympathetic nervous system is ascended, and they are alive, alert, energetic, and involved. When they go home, the parasympathetic backlash hits, and they become tired, detached, isolated, and apathetic. The greater the excitement and demand of work, the greater the potential for a backlash that can debilitate them in their home life and destroy their family. The purpose of this audiobook is to prepare warriors for the reality of combat, and we will focus on the parasympathetic backlash from a specific combat experience. But Gilmartin's book, Emotional Survival, is mandatory reading for all warriors to help them understand how to manage this daily biological roller coaster. Managing daily stress is vitally important because we are continuously bombarded with it. Life and death combat incidents are comparatively rare. But when they do occur, managing the emotional, physiological crisis after the event can be even more important. In the immediate days after a combat situation, a warrior can be at his most vulnerable. He may be so sleep-deprived, confused, uncertain, and physiologically out of balance that he might respond to a subsequent combat situation with an inappropriate level of aggression. Think of a warrior as a finely calibrated machine. His job is to decide, in a fraction of a second, exactly how much force to use. If he should use a little too much, he gets in trouble. And if he uses too little, he can die. In the first few days after a shooting, the calibration on this finely tuned individual may be out of whack. Art Wall and Christensen's book, Deadly Force Encounters, contains copies of the International Association of Chiefs of Police protocols, which state that after a law enforcement officer has been in a gunfight, he should be given 3 or 4 days off so that he can recover from the extraordinary event. If he does not get this time to recuperate, and he is thrust into another stressful event, he is vulnerable to severe psychological damage as a result of additional stress stacked on top of the original stress. More on this later when I talk about the bathtub model of stress. Consider this example of a veteran warrior who intuitively understood this concept. I've been involved in 3 shootings over my 14-year career. After the first one, I went right back to work because that's what everyone did. No debriefings, no talking. Just get back out there and prove to yourself and others that it didn't bother you. After my second shooting, I had come to realize that that approach was a mistake. I decided to take care of myself regardless of what my agency or any of my fellow officers had to say. I didn't go right back out, but instead took 2 weeks off. Afterwards, I was getting restless and eager to return to the work I love so much. So I went back. I walked into the locker room and put on my uniform and my gun belt, but it felt wrong. I knew I wasn't ready to be on the street, and I definitely wasn't ready to go out there and make life or death decisions. So I took off my uniform and told, not asked, my sergeant that I was going home. I didn't care what he thought. It was my life, and I knew that I cared about it more than anyone else. I was going to protect it. So I took another week off, and this time when I went back, it felt right. I walked out of the locker room with my uniform and gun belt on, and I knew I was ready. Then, on my second shift back, I got into my third shooting. Since I had allowed time to recover from the second shooting, I was ready to survive physically and psychologically. And I did. Today, I'm doing fine with all 3 shootings, and I'm still on full active duty. A police officer from Deadly Force Encounters. In past wars, we tended to wait until a soldier was mentally or emotionally broken before we would pull them out of the front lines. In the 2003 invasion of Iraq, when combatants began to show signs of stress, the policy was to rotate them back to where they could get a shower and a brief rest, and then put them right back with their units. One USA Today report stated that usually they snap back and would begin to demonstrate the subtle swagger that communicates the unconscious confidence of a combat veteran. The loss of one man for a day or so is not such a big price to pay if you realize that the alternative may be to lose that warrior permanently. Warriors in combat don't always have the luxury of being able to pull out. But think of it this way. If you were a football coach and one of your players took a hard hit in the head, you would take him out of the game for a while so he could recuperate. While he might want to go back in, you would tell him to sit on the bench for a couple of plays because it is a 4-quarter game and you need him for the whole game. A warrior is in the game for all 4 quarters too, so he must pace himself. Shoving him back into the breach too soon just might cut short his career or cause him to fail at a critical moment when others are depending upon him. The moment of greatest vulnerability. Oh, moment of sweet peril. Edward Robert, Earl of Lytton. Look at the officer versus suspect stress graph on the PDF that accompanies this audiobook, and note the difference between the officer and the suspect during and after a violent arrest. This was first introduced by the U.S. Marshals in reference to escapes during prisoner transports. but it has far wider and broader application to military and law enforcement. The officer went into the arrest when he was in condition red, a heightened state of alertness and awareness. He managed to catch a suspect when the man was completely off guard, in condition white. There was a scuffle, and the officer got the man cuffed and stuffed into the back seat of the patrol vehicle. Now, if the officer is not careful on the way back to the station, he might think that the danger is over and allow himself to relax. Meanwhile, the suspect is still high on adrenaline and growing increasingly unhappy over the loss of his freedom. Consider what happened in one tragic incident in Florida. Two trained, competent detectives arrested and handcuffed a man after a short chase. They put the man's rifle in the trunk of their police car and sat him in their back seat, unaware that the career criminal carried a handcuff key around his neck. While being transported to jail, the suspect used the key to get out of the handcuffs and then lunged at the detectives, disarming one of them. He emptied the gun into both detectives, killing them both, and then kicked their bodies out of the car. He retrieved his rifle from the trunk and, after a high-speed chase, killed a state trooper and then took a hostage in a gas station. The standoff ended when the suspect took his own life. So, how is it possible for an unarmed, handcuffed man to overwhelm and kill two armed and trained detectives? The answer lies in the minds and bodies of the officers and the suspect. The officers had probably relaxed after the chase and the arrest and were experiencing a parasympathetic backlash, while the suspect had not yet begun to fight. We know that a cooperative person can have a violent psychological response to hearing the clicking sound made when a pair of handcuffs open. Similarly, we know that many times as a police car nears the jail and the officers have relaxed their guard after the arrest, the sight of the structure can spark a violent reaction in the prisoner. Consider this example. Before our shiny new glass and plastic high-rise jail was built, we housed prisoners in an ancient, three-story stone structure. It was an ugly place, dark, medieval, and dungeon-like, with towers and barbed wire. The problem was that prisoners in the back seat could see the dungeon as we neared the place, and many times they would go completely berserk when we opened the back door to get them out. Their violent reaction often took us by surprise because we had mellowed out after the arrest and long drive. Both military personnel and law enforcement officers need to understand that they can be vulnerable when a prisoner sees their final destination. Just as there is a psychological impact on some prisoners to seeing the jail out the backseat window of a police car, there are also prisoners who react violently upon seeing a jail cell. Law enforcement officers and military personnel handling POWs must have careful processes in place to make sure that prisoners are treated appropriately, weapons have been removed and secured, and every step is done properly. This should include ensuring that officers and guards are alert and ready in the booking facility or POW handling area. Many police departments require that a fresh officer take over because they understand that there might be a dangerous vulnerability. Consolidation and reorganization on the objective is a standard military term for what occurs after victory. The enemy has fled, and the hilltop has been secured. The battle is over. Or is it? Remember Napoleon's words that the moment of greatest vulnerability is immediately after victory. This is why a smart military leader will counterattack immediately after the enemy has pushed his troops off a position. It's preferable for the leader to counter with fresh reserves, soldiers not depleted from the physical and psychological roller coaster ride of the fight. Since the enemy might relax and become vulnerable in their victory, it is possible that even a small force could overpower them and recapture the objective. In order to prevent warriors from becoming vulnerable after they have secured an objective, they should be trained to automatically begin a series of tasks to keep them occupied. They should establish 360-degree security and prepare defensive positions and fields of fire in the event of an enemy counterattack. They should redistribute ammo, drink lots of fluids, provide first aid, evacuate casualties and prisoners, and account for all equipment. Leaders should supervise and report the situation to a higher authority. In the military and on SWAT teams, the acronym LACE, L-A-C-E, is often used to define this swirl of activities: liquids, ammunition, casualties, and equipment. By rehearsing this continuation of operations during training, warriors in real combat will not relax during this vulnerable moment, but stay busy performing the vital duties required to survive and thrive on the battlefield. This is sometimes referred to as follow-through considerations in the law enforcement community. As Gary Klugowitz says to his students, "It's not Miller time now. There's still a lot to be done before the mission is complete." Military, police officers, firefighters, paramedics, and others working in stressful occupations need to develop this mindset by practicing consolidation and reorganization so they are ready to take on the next mission. For those in such professions, the next high-risk call can come at any time, and lives depend on their ability to drive on to the next objective. An old Japanese saying communicates this concept succinctly: after the battle, tighten your helmet straps. In other words, just because you have won, don't let down your guard. No man knows but a soldier how sweet sleep is. With a sandbag for a pillow, I chase a distant memory of a thing called sleep. I whisper in the dark and pray God my soul to keep. James Adam Holland, The Freedom of a Soldier. Throughout early history, man almost always got enough sleep, because when the sun went down, there was nothing else to do. You could only have so much sex and do so much talking, then you rolled over and went to sleep. So the human body never had to develop the powerful signals needed to make you get enough sleep. Then, with the arrival of cheap artificial lighting, man was physically able to go nonstop for days on end. But psychologically and physiologically, the human body is not designed to go for long periods without sleep. We are not even sure why we need sleep. When U.S. News and World Report magazine did a special on the great mysteries of science a few years ago, one of the mysteries discussed was, why do we need sleep? We do not understand why we dream, and we do not even understand why, for example, males get an erection and females experience clitoral engorgement during rapid eye movement, REM sleep stage. In the psychology curriculum at West Point, we teach that this is why males sometimes awake with an erection. Urinating is a non-sexual act which apparently sends a message to the body that makes the erection go away. But the erection does not occur just because your bladder is full. Everything about sleep is a mystery, but one thing is certain. Our body needs four things to survive: air, water, food, and sleep. You can die from lack of sleep faster than you can die from lack of food. Your body sends powerful signals that make you breathe, drink, and eat. But over the millennia, there has been little need for the body to send strong sleep signals. Those that are sent can be pushed aside and ignored far more easily than the signals for other essential requirements for survival. All of us know that missed sleep makes us feel drowsy and lousy, but most people are unaware of the profound negative impact on health and performance associated with the lack of sleep. Stress is a major destroyer and disabler of warriors. More soldiers were pulled out of combat in World War I, World War II, and Korea because of psychiatric casualties than were killed by the enemy. Without argument, stress is a primary concern for our warriors and their leaders. And one of the best ways to heal and recover from psychological stress is to sleep. Sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care, as Shakespeare put it. Sleep deprivation is the best way to physically predispose yourself to become a stress casualty. It has been linked to mental health problems, cancer, common colds, depression, diabetes, obesity, and stroke. As it relates to job performance, sleep deprivation impairs reaction time, judgment, vision, information processing, short-term memory, performance, motivation, vigilance, and patience. On the other hand, research shows that sufficient sleep combined with a nutritious diet, lots of fluids, and exercise are critical for a long and healthy life. Unfortunately, our society is full of sincerely deluded people who honestly believe that they can get by forever on 4 hours of sleep. When you take Mr. I Can Go Forever on 4 hours of sleep and put him in the timeless environment of the sleep lab, he immediately begins to catch up on his sleep debt. He may sleep up to 12 hours a day until he has recuperated, and then he sleeps 7, 8, and 9 hours a day on a normal, healthy sleep cycle. Scientists used to say that you could not catch up on lost sleep, but now we know they were wrong. Dead wrong, as in killing people wrong. Your body builds up a sleep debt. And just as you can catch up on dehydration and malnutrition, you can catch up on sleep. So, if you got only 3 hours sleep last night, you can use caffeine to get yourself through the day. But as soon as you get a chance, sleep in late or take some major naps to catch up on your sleep debt. There was a study conducted by the United States Army on an artillery battalion. The troops suffered terribly for us to get this data, so perhaps we should pay attention. The battalion was divided into 4 batteries and then conducted fire missions, artillery exercises, for 20 days straight, every waking hour of every day. The 1st battery, Group 1, got 7 hours of sleep a day. Group 2 got 6 hours. Group 3 got 5. And Group 4 really suffered, with only 4 hours sleep a day. At the end of 20 days, Group 1, which got 7 hours of sleep, fired at 98% of peak efficiency. Group 2 fired at 50%. Group 3 at 28%. And the poor guys who got only 4 hours sleep fired at 15% of peak efficiency. The 4-hour group was not only useless, they were dangerous. When you get about 7 hours sleep a night, you can go a long time, though 8 is probably better. Any less, and you start building up a sleep debt that can take a profound psychological and physiological toll. If you spend your life severely malnourished, it will probably take years off your life. Likewise, if you lead your life severely sleep-deprived, it will probably take years off your life. Few healthy individuals will voluntarily lead a malnourished life, but many individuals do voluntarily lead a sleep-deprived life. Throughout history, sleep has always been the soldier's best medicine. In World War I and World War II, troops would rotate out of the trenches or out of the front lines, and the first thing they would do is sleep. But in Iraq, in Afghanistan, U.S. troops coming off combat patrols would often return to their barracks and play video games, watch DVDs and television, and surf the internet. This form of escapism and the false sense of control given by video games seemed to be incredibly alluring as well as addictive to men and women in combat. In reality, this can be a self-inflicted wound that greatly increases their vulnerability to PTSD and to illness, since the immune system diminishes with sleep deprivation. Every pro ball team on the planet has lights out by at least 10 or 11 o'clock the night before a game. If a pro ball player stayed up the night before a game, playing video games or watching TV, the other players would kick his tail, the coach would fine him, and that nonsense would stop immediately. Well, our military and our cops are their cities and their nation's pro team. But in this game, in the merciless, unforgiving, high-stakes game of combat, if you lose, people die. We are warriors. We are willing to walk out the door and suck up bullets if we have to. But it ought to seriously tick you off to suck up bullets when it could have been avoided. Similarly, we are willing to be sleep-deprived if the mission absolutely demands it. But it ought to seriously tick you off to be sleep-deprived if it could have been avoided. And if you do it to yourself, it is a self-inflicted wound. Thus, the U.S. military has learned that sleep management can be a major war-winning, war-losing issue. And if a large number of PTSD cases have come out of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, this could be a major reason why. So our senior NCOs and officers have accepted the responsibility to be mommy and make the troops get the sleep they need. I tell this to my police officers I teach, and then I ask them, who's going to be your mommy? You have to do it yourself. You have to make it happen. It is a matter of professionalism and self-discipline, a matter of life and death, as are so many things for those who walk the razor's edge in the merciless, unforgiving realm of combat. The equivalent of legally drunk. Like a drunken sailor on a mast, ready with every nod to tumble down. Shakespeare, King Richard III. A person deprived of sleep for 24 hours is virtually the physiological and psychological equivalent of being legally drunk. Dr. Jacques Gauss, a retired military psychologist, makes the point that this can be even more so in the combat zone, where you are pumping adrenaline like mad, and not just infrequently, as the cops do. The soldier in combat is physically and emotionally significantly more fatigued because of the duration of the sustained military combat operations. Tired Cops, The Importance of Managing Police Fatigue, by Dr. Brian Vila, is a superb book that should be mandatory reading for everyone in the warrior community. In this book, Dr. Vila tells about one study which showed that sleep-deprived people scored as badly or worse on reaction time tests as those with a blood alcohol level of 0.10%, a percentage deemed legally drunk in all states. After alcohol intoxication, lack of sleep is the next major cause of accidents. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration links nearly 100,000 crashes a year to drowsiness. Over a century ago, railroad engineers were required by federal law to get enough sleep. Today, airline pilots, truckers, nuclear power plant operators, air traffic controllers, and many others are also mandated to get sufficient sleep for their jobs. In the summer of 2002, the medical community established regulations requiring that doctors and interns get enough sleep because the legal liability of having zombie-like medical personnel making life and death decisions was simply too great. Sleep deprivation inflicted upon students in a controlled training environment can be a useful form of stress inoculation. But every effort must be made to avoid sleep deprivation if the students have to make real decisions that might result in the loss of lives, such as doctors in a hospital and military leaders in combat. When I was in Ranger School, the U.S. Army used weeks of extensive food and sleep deprivation to provide stress inoculation designed to prepare me for the stress of combat leadership. This training is highly effective, and it works in controlled environments where lives are not on the line and dangerous situations are closely monitored. Also, sleep deprivation in leadership schools teaches you how to work with and lead sleep-deprived people. Sleep-deprived warriors will have greater difficulty understanding what you tell them, so you learn to speak in simple sentences, avoid giving them complex tasks, break tasks into simple intermediate objectives, repeat the essential points, have them repeat your instructions back to you, and closely supervise their performance. These are all valuable lessons to learn in training. But in situations where lives are on the line, we must do everything humanly possible to make sure that the individuals who are responsible for human lives get enough sleep. We must not deprive students of sleep or food for so long that it does physical harm. Indeed, in recent years, the use of food deprivation in Ranger School has been reduced after long-term studies determined that just those few months of food and sleep deprivation were causing serious long-term health effects on the students. As Dr. Cleet DiGiovanni put it, you cannot condition yourself to get by with significantly less sleep. The lesson that Rangers should take from Ranger School is not that they are immortal and don't need sleep or food. The lesson a wise man takes from such experiences is to remember just how poorly you performed when you were sleep deprived, and to remember to always sleep and eat whenever you get the chance. Today, the medical community must adhere to strict regulations that require them to get enough sleep so that they can perform their life and death duties. Police officers, peacekeepers, and combat soldiers, however, have no such requirements. Today's understaffed and overworked warriors carry guns, drive vehicles, and make life and death decisions, all the while suffering from sleep deprivation. I guarantee that a sleepy police officer, or maybe even a sleepy peacekeeper, will one day soon make a questionable decision that negligently hurts or kills someone. When the case goes to court, the lawyer will ask, "Officer, how much sleep did you get the night before the incident? How much sleep the night before that? And the night before that?" They will subpoena the officer's work logs to show the volume of overtime he worked. And they will show that he, like so many other officers today, had no more than 4 hours sleep each night for the last 20 days. Or, better yet, from the accusing lawyer's standpoint, he will prove that the officer had not slept for 24 hours and was therefore the equivalent of being legally drunk. Then the lawyer will ask the jury what they think the officer would do if he caught them legally drunk behind the wheel of a vehicle. The result of such a lawsuit to the officer and the department would be devastating. When a warrior is sleep deprived, he is grouchy. His IQ seems to go down. His hand and eye coordination is poor, and he nods off at inappropriate times. My co-author tells of an officer in his department who worked 2 weeks of double shifts and a couple of triple shifts, meaning 24 solid hours. Officers working in neighboring patrol districts complained of his poor performance and incoherent speech. The sleep-deprived officer told Christensen that he was so fatigued that he had stopped taking a shotgun out with him because he was unable to handle it safely. Clearly, this was an injury and a lawsuit waiting to happen. Fortunately, the 2 weeks passed without officers or citizens getting hurt or the department getting sued. When sleep deprivation and its dangerous side effects happen on overtime, the only good thing is that the officer is making 1.5 times more money than one on regular time, but the risk is too great. Let's look at this from another angle. Say you are a police chief or a combat unit commander, and Like most organizations, you're short on manpower. I come to you from, say, Brand X Academy, and offer to let you hire my Brand X officers. I tell you that they have an IQ 5 or 10 points less than the average cop or soldier. Their hand and eye coordination is poor. They are incredibly grouchy. Their decision-making skills are virtually non-existent, and they tend to nod off. Oh, and I might ask that you pay 1.5 times as much overtime pay for these warriors. You want them? I can hazard a guess as to where you would tell me to put my Brand X police officers or soldiers. The frightening reality is that my Brand Xers have the same negative characteristics as real sleep-deprived warriors working multiple shifts or overtime. Some people might think this is helping the organization, but with the possible exception of some extreme combat circumstances, they are wrong. As Colonel Gregory Belinke, the lead sleep researcher at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, puts it, there's nothing heroic about staying up. Sleep and PTSD. Oh, sleep, oh, gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse. Shakespeare, King Henry IV. Insufficient sleep and physical exhaustion is a key factor in predisposing you to be a stress casualty. As Patton said, fatigue makes cowards of us all. If we know that stress is a key disabler of warriors, and that lack of sleep is a key factor that predisposes warriors towards stress casualties, physical illness, and PTSD, then proper sleep management should be a no-brainer. Many law enforcement agencies have told me that they have a serious stress problem and want me to teach them how to deal with it. When I tell them that they must first ensure that everyone gets enough sleep, they argue that it is impossible. Okay, I say, then die. I'm kidding, of course, but I say it to make the point that if they want to enjoy a full career and watch their grandbabies grow, then one of the most important things they can do is manage their sleep. Exxon Valdez, Chernobyl, and Three Mile Island had one thing in common. They were all industrial accidents that occurred in the middle of the night involving people with sleep management problems. Insufficient sleep is responsible for billions of dollars of industrial accidents. Similar problems have been happening to our warriors for decades, and we are just now beginning to be held accountable for them. Yes, police agencies and military units are often in desperate need of manpower, but grinding the warriors they have into the dirt is not the answer. If we were to do to our airline pilots what we do to our cops and soldiers, 747s would be falling out of the sky like hailstones. During the Vietnam War and the Gulf War, soldiers went for days on end without rest or sleep. My co-author can recall many days of sleep deprivation in Vietnam. Christensen said that once he went so long without sleep that when he finally did get some, he slept through a rocket attack. If you have not been in one of those, believe it when I say they are really noisy. Due to a better understanding of a soldier's requirement for sleep, this type of deprivation is now considerably less common. Since the early 1970s, the United States military has tried to initiate a revolution in sleep management. Ideally, when the military goes long and hard, it is done intentionally, but then they immediately get themselves back on a sleep cycle, because they know that sleep is as vital as air, water, and food. Stephen Brust, one of my favorite authors, had a veteran military commander proclaim after reviewing the troops that, "I can always tell who has never seen battle before." A subordinate asks if that was because they seemed nervous. "No," the commander replies, "anyone in his right mind is nervous before battle." "Well," the subordinate asks, "is it because the green troops seem more eager than those with more experience?" "No, that's not it either." Finally, the subordinate asked directly, "Then how can you tell?" "Because they look more tired than the rest," the commander answered. Many old warriors have told me during my interviews with them that a soldier never misses the chance to sleep. As John Mosby said in his Civil War memoirs, no man knows but a soldier how sweet sleep is. Caffeine can be our friend. Nicotine is not. Good coffee is like friendship, rich and warm and strong. Pan American Coffee Bureau. Caffeine is a powerful and useful drug to temporarily combat the effects of sleep deprivation, but only if you have not abused it. If you need a 3-bagger to get you kick-started first thing in the morning, a 64-ounce Big Gulp Cola to keep you going throughout the morning, 2 or 3 big strong cups of coffee to get you going after lunch, and a big cup to face the family the end of the day, you are addicted and abusing a powerful drug that will not be there for you when you need it the most. It is best to use caffeine only when necessary, such as first thing in the morning and right after lunch, 2 times when most of us need a little help. Never use caffeine within 5 or 6 hours of bedtime. If caffeine does not bother your sleep, that is proof that you have already built up a powerful tolerance, and it will be ineffective when you need it. Cut back, but do not go cold turkey. Starting tomorrow, drink half of what you normally consume. Cut it in half the next day, and so on, until you're taking caffeine only 2 or 3 times a day. Then, when you really need it for that extended operation, it will be of use to you. Nicotine does not help sleep deprivation. There is always a troop out on the perimeter who says, if I could just have a smoke, I could stay awake. Wrong. After he completes the busy work of retrieving a cigarette and lighting it, he returns to being just as sleepy as he was before, but now he has a fire starter in his mouth. There is, however, one way that nicotine can help you with sleep deprivation. I was in Texas once giving a law enforcement presentation when an old Texas Ranger came up during a break and said, Colonel, you're wrong. Nicotine can keep you awake. I said, sir, who am I to argue with you? He said, no, listen to me. You've got to chew it. Well, I said, maybe if you have something in your mouth, I guess I can see that. No, listen to me. You have to chew your tobacco, spit it in your hand, and then rub it in your eyes. Actually, this is an old technique. The son of a World War II veteran told me about his father, a man who had been besieged in Bastogne in the Battle of the Bulge with the 101st Airborne Division. He said that the enemy kept attacking relentlessly day after day, making it impossible for him and his fellow soldiers to sleep because they did not know when they would be hit again. To stay awake and alert, they would take a cigarette, remove a little flake of tobacco, and drop it under the eyelid of their non-firing eye, the one not used to sight your rifle. It burned and stung so badly that it was impossible for them to drift asleep. Pain will keep you awake, and that's the only way nicotine will do you any good. Chapter 4. Fear, Physiological Arousal, and Performance. Conditions white, yellow, red, gray, and black. On the battlefield, the real enemy is fear, not the bayonet or bullet. Robert Jackson. Conditions white, yellow, and red. We boil at different degrees. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Eloquence. When you are asleep or just going about your day unfocused and unprepared for anything bad to happen, you are at your lowest level of readiness. Call it condition white, a place where you are helpless, vulnerable, and in denial. White is for sheep. When you move up to a level of basic alertness and readiness, a place where you are psychologically prepared for combat, you have entered the realm of condition yellow. Dogs, who are predators by nature, seldom leave condition yellow. They are always ready to play, fight, frolic, mate, or run. They are survivors. Warriors, too, must strive to exist in condition yellow. A warrior always tries to sit with his back to the wall. There is no specific heart rate associated with condition white and condition yellow. The difference is more psychological than physiological. However, as the level of arousal increases, we can begin to associate the condition levels with specific heart rate levels. There is a zone that exists generally between 115 and 145 beats per minute, where you are at your optimal survival and combat performance level. Let us call this condition red. Your complex motor skills, visual reaction time, and cognitive reaction time are all at their peak, but you begin to pay a price. Starting around 115 beats per minute, your fine motor skills begin to deteriorate. We should be cautious about fixing specific heart rate numbers or any other precise measure of physiological arousal on condition yellow, red, or black. The impact of these conditions can vary greatly depending on training, physical fitness, and other factors. Also, it must be understood that these heart rates apply only to survival stress or fear-induced heart rate increases. You can do a set of wind sprints and get your heart rate to 200 beats per minute. But the effect of this exercise-induced heart rate increase will not be the same as when fear or survival stress causes the increase. Furthermore, when you combine the vasoconstriction of fear-induced heart rate increase with physical exertion or exercise demands, the result seems to be an amplifying effect, which can result in some extraordinarily high heart rates. So we must note that physiological factors are poor indicators of combat performance, since so much depends upon individual characteristics. Still, everyone has a condition yellow, red, and black, and it is important to understand how physiological arousal can interact with combat performance. Thus, 115 beats per minute is not an absolute with every person, but for most it is a starting point. Police officers often see a symptom of this when they stop a motorist for a traffic violation, and the driver's hand shakes so badly that he can barely sign the ticket. The same is true of people involved in a traffic accident, when afterwards they have difficulty scrawling down their telephone number. Such symptoms are a result of early stages of vasoconstriction, a condition that restricts the flow of blood to the extremities. Our frequently trained special operations warriors. When you think about Spec Ops, you envision Rangers, Green Berets, or SEALs. But a large portion of our Special Ops community also consists of the superb pilots and flight crews who support these elite warriors. Some U.S. Air Force pilots I have worked with told me about one pilot trainer who gives them small yellow dots with adhesive on the back. The pilots stick these dots on their watches and on their cockpits as a reminder to stay in condition yellow, alert, but not over-aroused. If a pilot becomes too aroused and begins to enter condition red, the price he pays is a loss of fine motor skills. Having your helicopter pilot lose his fine motor control as he makes a close approach on a hot landing zone is not a good thing. Pilots try to exist in a zen-like state of constant mellow yellow. Other warriors may also maintain a state of condition yellow. For example, when I train hostage negotiators, I stress the importance of functioning in condition yellow. I am proud to be a member of the Board of Technical Advisors for the American Sniper Association, which is probably the world's leading private law enforcement and military sniper training organization. Snipers must maintain precision fine motor skills. So when I train them, I emphasize the need to remain in condition yellow. I had the privilege of training an international bomb technicians conference. Now that is a group of individuals who must remain calm and in condition yellow when they're doing their job. It's an entirely different situation for the point man on a SWAT team going through a door to confront a barricaded gunman. He needs to have his cognitive reaction time visual reaction time, and complex motor skills all functioning at the highest levels. He needs to be in condition writ. Yes, he loses some of his fine motor skills. But in his case, that is an acceptable price to pay. Through intense, high-repetition training, he will turn the skills